Well, good afternoon and welcome. KLPZ, 1380 AM Country and a little more. It is the big show this afternoon with myself, John Wright, Belfast Beaver. We're here until 5 o'clock this afternoon, and my guest this hour is Dr. Nick Bostrom, director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University, the co-founder of the World Transhumanist Association, which now has more than 4,400 members worldwide, and also co-founder of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Good afternoon, Nick. How are you today?
Good afternoon.
Are you doing all right? Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Good. How are you?
Fine, thanks. It's not afternoon, but actually evening over here in the UK.
That's right. I know it's late. What time is it right there at the moment?
It's 11:05.
Okay, well, I'll try and keep this this pretty concise then, so you can get to bed at some point soon. Thanks for doing this. I've been very interested in the simulation argument since I read it. I've explained it to our listeners as best as I can. Maybe you can just tell me what the theory is in layman's terms.
All right, well, we first need the concept of an ancestor simulation. An ancestor simulation would be a computer simulation of people like historical ancestors that we have here on Earth.
Okay.
But not just any computer simulation, but one that would be detailed enough that the simulated people would actually be conscious.
So now,
such a simulation, sorry?
Current simulations that we have, they're becoming more and more detailed all the time, isn't that right? So at some point, presumably in the future, what you're postulating is that they might get detailed enough to simulate ourselves, to simulate people like us.
Yeah, so that would presumably require simulating brains down to the level of individual nerve cells, perhaps, and synaptic connections.
Mm-hmm.
So it's far beyond any simulations that we have today or
right.
will be able to create in the near future.
Yes.
So the simulation argument then tries to show that one of three possibilities is true. It doesn't tell us which one of these three, just that at least one is true.
Okay.
And those three possibilities are, one, that almost all civilizations at our current stage of development go extinct before reaching technological maturity. The second possibility is that there is a very strong convergence among all technologically mature civilizations throughout the universe in that they all lose interest in creating ancestor simulations.
Okay.
So on the second possibility, they might be technologically mature civilizations. They might have all these technologies, planetary-sized supercomputers, etc. But they have better things to do with this than create ancestor simulations. That's the second possibility.
Okay.
The third possibility is the simulation hypothesis that we are living in a computer simulation. Literally, that is, in one of these ancestor simulations, perhaps, created by some advanced civilization somewhere.
So the third possibility is that we're in one right now. Now, why could it not be the case that in the future we do create ancestor simulations and that we have the capability of doing that, but that maybe we're not in a simulation right now? Why is that not a possibility?
Well, so the simulation argument runs by considering if the first two alternatives are do not obtain. So that means that some significant fraction of all civilizations at our stage will eventually become technologically mature,
mm-hmm.
and some significant fraction of those will be interested in creating these ancestor simulations and will use some portion of the resources to doing that. You can then show that even if they used only a tiny fraction of their computer time or resources for this end, they could create astronomically many such ancestor simulations.
Mm.
So if you assume that the first two possibilities are false, you get the implication that there are many, many more people living in ancestor simulations than there are people living in original runs of history.
Okay, so it's some basic probability theory. It just looks like we would be one of the minority if we were, in fact, the real ones and everyone else is simulated.
Yes, that's correct. And you can back up this final step with additional arguments, the final step being if most people like us are simulated and only a tiny minority are non-simulated, then we have strong reason to think that we are probably one of the simulated majority rather than one of the rare exceptions.
Mm. And what do people say when you propose this argument to them? Maybe people that aren't trained in philosophy or maybe just average Joes on the street. Have you ever kind of proposed this to someone and had them ask you what you're smoking or something? I mean, what do people generally respond with?
Well, the response seems to depend on how directly exposed to the argument they have been. So people who have read the original paper that I published in Philosophical Quarterly a few years ago, or mm-hmm. who have heard me give the full explanation, they are usually intrigued and find the argument quite persuasive, most of them. People who read second-hand accounts of it, or third-hand accounts, I think it's increasingly far-fetched, especially if they don't actually hear the argument behind the claim, but just the idea that we are in a simulation.
If you walked up to someone and just said we're in a simulation right now and didn't give any reasons for it, I'm presuming they'd be a little more skeptical than when they've actually read your... It runs to about 11 pages, right, your paper? I've read it over the weekend.
It's a short one. I mean, it's like 10, 15 pages or something.
Now, so far, whenever I've kind of introduced people to this idea, most of the reaction when we've talked about this is skeptical but not sure why. In other words, you know, they can't necessarily refute the argument, but they don't kind of like the idea. Why do you think people don't like the idea?
Well, I mean, the conclusion would be surprising, and you don't just accept any surprising conclusion immediately. You want to make very sure whether the argument really supports it. So in a sense, it's rational that you don't immediately jump on board and accept any strange-sounding conclusion that you can't immediately see a flaw with the argument for.
Mm.
Now, it's also important to emphasize that what I believe is the simulation argument, but that argument, as I just mentioned, only tries to show that one of three possibilities is correct. And so I'm agnostic as to which of those three possibilities it is.
Right, so you're not exactly arguing that we are in a simulation. You're saying that there's
right.
a possibility. Now, I've heard you say a couple of times that you give the chance of that, of us being in a simulation right now, about 20%. So you've assigned one of the other hypotheses a higher chance, right?
Yeah,
do you think we go extinct before we develop the capability, or what do you think is the most likely scenario?
Well, I think I've been quoted as saying that my gut feeling is that there is a 20% probability that we are in a simulation.
Mm.
I also have a knee feeling that it's only 3%.
Okay.
And
so you would like to think it's 3%?
Well, no, but the point being that these probability assignments are really subjective. And I don't think there are any good grounds for picking one or the other. So you asked me before, what is the reaction among people when I tell the argument?
Mm-hmm.
And one common reaction is that, yes, the argument is true, but moreover, it's obvious that it's alternative X that's the correct one. Different people pick a different X. So some people think it's obvious that it's the first one, or other people think it's clear that it must be the second possibility, and some that it's the third one.
Right. Isn't that interesting, though, that a few people have this concept that whenever they read your paper, they come away, you know, a different set of people will come away with an entirely different idea at the end of it. I remember hearing one person say that they thought that the probability, of us being in a simulation is more like 60 or 70% after reading your paper. They were very convinced.
I mean, you can speculate. You could imagine that there is this super intelligent entity that creates these simulations in order to predict if there are any other similar entities in the universe and what they would be like.
Yeah.
You can make all sorts of scenarios. You could imagine people using this as some sort of historical tourism in the future. So you could step into a virtual environment simulation of the past. If time travel is impossible, the second best thing might be to create a very realistic simulation, and then maybe these...
That's an interesting thought, because it could be the case then that some of the people that we see around us are imposters from the future engaged in, like you say, virtual tourism.
Yeah, there are many, many possibilities.
What if the creators of the simulation have gone extinct themselves, and it's just a kind of self-replicating system now running on automation?
Possible. It doesn't seem so likely. The computer would have to keep going.
It's certainly an interesting thought. Once you start, it's like one of those things, it's Pandora's box, you know. Once you open the door, you can almost think of any number of scenarios that might be the case. One thing I've thought about is, and I know that you've thought a bit about this, what would happen if we tried to develop our own ancestor simulation? Say we could do it tomorrow. It would required double the computing power, say, to maybe allow the simulated humans to build their own simulations. So we are simulated ourselves, but we're building a simulation. And I know you've thought a bit about the consequences of that as well, which, of course, then leads to the possibility of our simulators, whoever is simulating us, also being simulated as well.
Yeah, so that could be nested simulations with simulations within simulations and so on. And even if our simulators were not, in fact, simulated, they couldn't be sure about that. So they would at least have to suspect that they were.
Now, a lot of the response that we've got on this is to do with the idea of how this relates to religion. What are the religious connotations of this? Because the concept of God being a computer programmer in a futuristic society of some kind with others just like him is hard for people to grasp. But in reality, it's basically a kind of an argument for the existence of God, isn't it? I've heard that atheists have changed their mind after hearing your argument. Is that right?
It's happened, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the hypothetical simulators would, in some sense, be like gods relative to their simulated creatures, in that they would have sort of created the world as we see and experience. They would presumably be super intelligent in order to be able to create these simulations in the first place, and they would be able to intervene in our world if they wanted to, even in ways that contravene the laws of physics as we perceive them within this simulated world that we live in. Whether or not we are in a simulation, you might still ask the question whether there is a God that created everything that exists. You could hold either combination of views, I think.
Right, so this doesn't attempt to disprove God in any way?
No, nor to prove it.
Right. Now, there are some other concepts you're involved with that most of our audience won't have heard of before. Maybe before you go, let's just do like 20 seconds on each of these. Are you up for that?
All right, let's give it a try.
Okay, what is transhumanism?
It's a sort of small little movement or an idea that advocates the use of technologies to enhance human capacities and that seeks to promote individual choice and access to human enhancement capacities to extend, for example, human lifespan, improve memory, emotional well-being, and so on.
So to use technology in maybe the way that we correct bad eyesight, we would be correcting the problems of aging and that sort of thing.
Yes, but in addition to correcting specific problems, it might also create opportunities to improve something, even if there was no specific defect or something that was broken, but you could just have better memory than normal or more intelligence than normal or whatever.
I see. So it's not just problems, but it's also the possibilities that you haven't even thought of yet, maybe the potential of humankind to do something beyond what we're used to doing.
Well, the core of transhumanism is the rejection of this idea that there is something fundamentally different about using enhancement technologies of these new unconventional kinds and using the technologies we have always done, whether it's drinking a cup of coffee to become more awake or having an education to enhance your mind. There is no fundamental moral difference between these different ways of trying to enhance the quality of human life. And also it's the idea that individuals, as far as possible, should have the opportunity to make these choices for themselves.
So it's inevitably it's got a lot of focus on the future then and what could be possible for humankind in the future. Do you want to be frozen by cryonics when you die?
Yeah. I mean, if I think it gives you a slightly better odds than if you are cremated or buried.
Yeah. I mean, there's always the possibility that cryonics will provide that someday, you know, you might be able to be revived in a more futuristic society, in a society that maybe some of these things you're talking about might be able to take place. Let's go to another couple of these. What is the gray goo scenario?
This was originally coined by Eric Drexler as the catastrophe scenario with advanced nanotechnology. Sort of self-replicating nanotechnological machines running amok in the natural environment and eating up all organic matter and everything and turning it all into some sort of gray goo.
What is the singularity?
It's a hypothetical point in the future where the rate of technological advancement becomes so rapid that virtually overnight the world is radically transformed. That's in the more wide definition. It also has a more specific meaning, which would be the development of greater than human artificial intelligence. If you imagine an AI becoming smart enough that it can use its intelligence to create a better version of itself, and then that enhanced artificial intelligence, being even smarter, can make even more improvements, even more quickly to itself. You could, in some scenario, get an intelligence explosion, where you get a radically super-intelligent machine, and that could then create a sort of singularity.
Possibly a pretty scary thought.
I think that if we're talking about existential risks, which are threats to human survival, then superintelligence would rank very high up there among the main existential risks that
yeah.
we'll face in
yeah.
the century.
Yeah, I would say so. You must have such a fun job.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
What is uploading?
Uploading is a hypothetical technological procedure in which you would create a detailed scan of a particular brain, a three-dimensional scan, maybe by slicing it up into thin slices and then
Ouch.
Having an automated microscope scan that very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would reconstruct a three-dimensional model of the brain that you had scanned, and then you would emulate that in a very powerful computer. The idea being that you could then transfer the mind that was originally implemented in a biological brain and would now be running as a computer emulation.
So it would be like me existing in a computer?
Yeah, or I mean, not necessarily you.
I would like to be in a computer, you know, I'm not kidding you. Yeah. Well, you know, just a small sample of the work you're involved in, and it boggles the mind. You know, the ideas are fascinating, and of course they go to the core of the big picture. What have you been involved in the past, say, 3 or 4 years that you're just very, very into right now? What are you most into? What are you most interested in at the moment?
I mean, right now, as of this week or so, I'm spending a lot of my time on the book on global catastrophic risks that I'm editor of. That is coming out with Oxford University Press, hopefully early next year.
Okay, so now that is global catastrophic risk in the short term or in the very long-term future?
Primarily in the short term.
I see.
And so global catastrophic risk is a wider category than existential risks. It includes things that fall short of human extinction,
yeah.
So nuclear wars and stuff like that.
Well, thank you so much. The simulation argument is intriguing, and I know there's a lot of interest from most of the people I've introduced this to, whether or not they think. And, of course, the first reaction, like you say, is always, you know, this is an idea that's kind of out there, and a lot of people are very interested in the follow-up and all that sort of thing. So thanks very much for agreeing to be with us today, and I hope we can chat sometime again.
Sure, it's been fun.
Nick Bostrom, have a great night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.